Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, a new director for the Vatican Observatory. We hear more about the history and the work of the Astronomical Study Center based in Arizona in the United States. A human face on a hidden problem. Muslim, Jewish, and Catholic leaders come together to support an international coalition demanding better conditions for migrants and refugees. And from tax collector to faithful follower of Christ, Pope Benedict continues his teaching on the apostles during his weekly general audience. Welcome to the programme. Earlier this month, Pope Benedict appointed a new director of the Vatican Observatory, located in the hilltop town of Castel Gandolfo, close to the papal summer residence. 43-year-old Argentinian Jesuit Father José Funes takes over from American Jesuit Father George Coyne, who served as director for over 26 years. An astronomical observatory was first established by Pope Leo XIII back in 1891 to promote research and demonstrate the Church's support for the sciences. In the 1980s, a new research base was set up in Arizona, located on top of Mount Graham, the highest peak in the south of the U.S. state. Around a dozen scientists, most of them Jesuits, operate the Arizona telescope and engage in advanced astrophysics, cosmology, galactic and extragalactic research. The vice director of the Arizona Observatory is Father Chris Corbally, and he told my colleague Susie Hodges more about the work of this little-known outpost of the Vatican on American soil.
Some people know us very well, and those are the friends who have been helping very much in building our new telescope out here in Arizona. Now, I suppose it's 12 years old, 13 years old coming up, so it's not so new, but it's still very active. Those who support us in that know us very well. Other people, yes, it's quite a surprise that the Vatican has such a scientific presence in the United States.
How and why did the Vatican go about finding such a site in Arizona? It was to do with the pollution, the light pollution, wasn't it, in Castel Gandolfo outside Rome?
Yes, it was the increasing amount of light up in the night sky at Castel Gandolfo that brought us to Arizona. Just as in 1935, the increasing amount of light in Rome brought us from the hill in Vatican City out to Castel Gandolfo. So it's a kind of a regular process. But initially, we didn't come to build a telescope here. We came to relocate people to have access to the telescopes that were already here in Arizona.
The Vatican, as you mentioned, does have its own telescope. Tell us something about it. Is it or was it a state-of-the-art one?
Well, our telescope was an afterthought. We first moved people and established a second research base. That's in 1980. And then because of our presence here and because of the University of Arizona's interest and project to build giant new telescopes, then we were offered the mirror, which is the heart of the telescope that we currently have here.
And how powerful is it?
Well, if you had it in your backyard, it would be very powerful indeed. In astronomy terms, professional astronomy terms nowadays, it's a very moderate size. It is 1.8 meters in diameter for its primary or main mirror. But that makes it a wonderful workhorse, so that one can get a lot of time on the telescope and do a lot of survey and monitoring kind of projects.
Is it true that some Native Americans from the Apache tribe objected to Mount Graham being used as a site for stargazing because they consider the mountain sacred? Is this still a sore point?
There was objection. The first objections were environmentalists saying that we were going to destroy the habitat of the Mount Graham red squirrel, which is a subspecies of red squirrel. When it was seemed to be that when that became clearly not an issue, then some local Apaches, some, I have to emphasize, were encouraged to find opposition to our presence. Some of that opposition continues today because, you know, all mountains are sacred to Native Americans, and obviously some mountains are more sacred than others, and Mount Graham is the tallest one in the region. But it's sacred to some and not to others.
So there's not a lot of ill feeling still?
There is some ill feeling, yes. On the other hand, I have been up on the mountain with a group of Apaches, among whom was an elder, so one of the leaders of the people. And she was very appreciative of the presence of telescopes up on that mountain, which she used for her own, you know, sacred rituals. So I found there is not a uniform approach among the Apaches. Like many people, there are differences of opinion. And yet when they speak out, then they need to speak in a uniform way. So one sometimes gets the wrong impression by listening, you know, as it were, to the official viewpoint. When one talks to them, there is a variety of viewpoints.
Now, when it comes to the astronomers working there at the Vatican Observatory in Arizona, are they all working on slightly different projects, or are they all contributing to one grand one, as it were?
The old style of an observatory was there was one grand project that was the pet project of the director, and all the minions, the staff, help with that project. That's not been true of an observatory for quite a long time. So, yes, all the members of the Vatican Observatory staff have different expertises and interests and different groups of collaborators. So all kinds of projects that we are pursuing there.
And can you give us a very brief example in layman terms of one of them?
Father Jose Funes, whose work is in galaxies. So galaxies are the collection of, in the order of 100,000 million stars, which dot our universe. Well, if you look out in the night sky, you will see the band of the Milky Way, which is actually the huge collection of stars in which our own sun is situated. So what Father Jose Funes is interested in, along with colleagues that work with him, is how galaxies have gone through their lifetime. And they have not been isolated from other galaxies. There's been interactions and even mergers, as if one big galaxy has made a meal of smaller galaxies. And the remains or the signs of that in the structure of how galaxies look at the moment. So that's a fascinating study of the history of galaxies in our universe. And Father Jose is using the Vatican telescope here, as well as other telescopes through the world, to explore this.
Church and science, of course, have had a somewhat troubled relationship at times, most famously in the 17th century when the church put Galileo, the astronomer, on trial for heresy for saying that the earth revolved around the sun. Do you believe that there's always destined to be a certain amount of tension between the two?
I think inevitably, yes, that there's going to be some tension between the church and science. Let's say not the church so much as religion or faith and science, because they can seem so different, and in a way they are. But the importance is, you know, that they are asking a different kind of questions about us and God and the universe. And if one gets the distinction between the question that's asked, then no, there isn't a controversy. But if one is not clear about the distinction, one thinks that one should be dictating to the other. And no, that can't be. They have the separate regime of understanding.
So is it easy for you to keep separate your role on one hand as an astronomer and on the other that as a Catholic priest, say when you're teaching? I mean, you don't find any kind of contradiction at times between your two roles?
No, not at all. There isn't any contradiction when I teach science. I don't suddenly feel that I have to be bringing in some theology in order to support the science. The science will stand on its own and in its own methodology. And yet, the science will also raise questions that are theological questions that are, and so are answered through theology. So it's the raising of questions is possible, as well as the interaction of one's faith on the way, not so much the method that one does science, but the manner, the integrity of doing science, belief that, yes, the whole universe is rational and understandable because there is a creator created in an understandable way. So there is an interaction, and yet there's also a separation in the methodology or the discipline of doing, answering the questions of each theology and of science.
You talked there about creation, and of course there's been quite a lot of controversy in recent years between those who believe in the creationism theory or the intelligent design theory, which is an offshoot of that, or rather Darwin's theory of evolution. And I gather that opinion polls show that a large number of Americans are more inclined to believe in the more literal, creationism theory or intelligence design. How do you explain that?
Explain the quite large, it's not a majority, but any quite large adherence to the biblical viewpoint of how everything started as a need for something that's secure, need to be assured of something. In the Catholic Church, our faith seems to be something that is very firm. There is the Bible, and there also is the 2 millennia tradition of people living the faith that is our foundation. Somehow I feel if you just concentrate on the Bible without that sort of background of lived faith so much, then there is a big need to see the words of the Bible as literally true exactly in what they say. And that anchors one's own security.
So do you see in some ways your job as helping to bridge the gap between church and science?
Yes, the Vatican Observatory is a bridge between the Catholic Church and the scientific world. It's not the only bridge because there's the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, which is a scientific society in all the sciences that is that bridge. So yes, what the Vatican Observatory shows is that, first of all, there is no conflict between faith and science. But not only that, that's the negative. But also there's an enormous positive and fruitful relationship that is possible between the two when you've sorted out what each the areas are. What's the area of faith and theology, and what's the area of scientific inquiry. And then if you do that, there is an enormous fruitful area.
Father Chris Corbally, Vice Director of the Arizona Observatory, talking to my colleague Susie Hodges. Here in the Vatican on Wednesday, Pope Benedict greeted thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered for his general audience in the Paul VI Audience Hall. Addressing them in their different languages, he continued his teaching on the first followers of Christ, the 12 apostles. Ema McCarthy takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
Early Wednesday morning, a white helicopter left the papal summer residence in the Alban Hills to bring Pope Benedict XVI north across the city of Rome to the Vatican for his audience with pilgrims and visitors. Over 8,000 people filled the Paul VI Audience Hall this week, including groups from Australia, Venezuela and Scandinavia. They had come to hear the Holy Father's catechesis on the Church's apostolic ministry, this week focusing on the figure of the Apostle Matthew.
Dear brothers and sisters, continuing our catechesis on the Church's apostolic ministry, we now turn to the Apostle Matthew. Matthew, the author of the first of the four Gospels, was a publican, a tax collector, and the story of his call to become an apostle reminds us that Christ excludes no one from his friendship. Tax collectors were considered public sinners, and we can hear an echo of the scandal caused by the Lord's decision to associate with such men in his declaration that he came not to call the just, but sinners. This is the heart of the good news which Jesus came to bring, the offer of God's grace to sinners. The parable of the publican in the temple makes the same point. By humbly acknowledging their sins and accepting God's mercy, even those who seem farthest from holiness can become first in the kingdom of heaven. Matthew's ready response to the Lord's call also shows that following Christ means leaving behind, sometimes at great cost, everything that is incompatible with true discipleship and embarking upon a new life. Through his example and the words of his gospel, St. Matthew constantly invites us to respond with joy to the good news of God's saving mercy.
As is tradition after his teachings, the Pope greeted visitors in many languages, including English.
May God give you the grace to deepen your love of Christ and this church, inspired by St. Matthew. I wish you all a blessed stay in Rome.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's weekly general audience. And finally, the rights of refugees must always be respected, and the Church must do all it can to help these brothers and sisters in need. That was Pope Benedict's message to mark the UN's World Refugee Day, celebrated in June each year to raise awareness of the plight of so many millions of people who continue to flee conflict and persecution and seek refuge in other countries. The Pope's words came as Muslim, Jewish and Catholic leaders here in Rome helped launch a new international coalition demanding better conditions for all refugees, migrants and asylum seekers. The coalition brings together over 100 non-governmental organisations, individuals and faith-based groups in countries across the globe, alarmed by the increasing use of lengthy detention in harsh conditions for people seeking safety and a decent standard of living.
Often it's a great shock to children and to adults to feel that they thought they'd reached safety. And then sometimes they're more affected by being put into detention in the country of supposed refuge than by the original abuse they suffered in their home countries, because they thought they were coming to safety.
Among the founding members of this new coalition is the Jesuit Refugee Service, which works with migrants and asylum seekers in over 50 countries around the world. JRS International Advocacy Coordinator Melanie Teff told me more about the unacceptable detention conditions in which many people, including children, are held, sometimes for years on end, while their requests for asylum are being processed.
We come across people who've survived torture who are then being placed in detention, which is reviving the psychological problems that they've suffered. We come across pregnant women in detention, nursing mothers in detention, but certainly the children grab the attention because it's so damaging for children to be growing up in these conditions. It really takes away their childhoods and leaves them with mental scars in the future. What we're seeing around the world is an increase in the use of immigration detention by governments, and we're seeing sometimes the worst practices of governments being exported, copied by other governments. And so we felt there was a need for a cross-regional response by NGOs and human rights groups.
How exactly is the coalition going to work?
Well, what the coalition is advocating for is to prevent and or limit the use of detention for asylum seekers, refugees and migrants, to advocate for alternatives to detention and for the use of the least restrictive forms of detention, to promote greater protection of and respect for the human rights of those held in detention. Really, we're asking governments to comply with what they've signed up to.
All governments are called to serve the human being.
Among those promoting the launch of this international network on June 15th was Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, head of both the Vatican Council for Justice and Peace and the Council for Migrants and Itinerant Peoples. He told me why the Church is in the forefront of this struggle to put a human face on these problems which are too often hidden behind prison walls.
The concern of all administration from government, international organization, is the service of the human being.
The Church is increasingly involved in this kind of advocacy, lobbying at the highest levels of the United Nations. Do you see this as a growing role of the Church?
Oh yes. Because this is based on the gospel. And as you heard, I was 16 years a representative of the Holy See to United Nations, and in my 16 years are countless the interventions that I made in exactly in the name of, on behalf of the refugees, and I proposed the refugee, not a number, but a human face.
Idea of some of the worst cases that you've seen, some of the experiences that would actually bring home to us the reality that so many of these people have to endure after they have fled from a situation of persecution in other countries.
Perhaps an example people don't often think of. In Zambia, a country which has very generously hosted many thousands of Angolan refugees, sadly, they've been living in camps which they've not been allowed to leave for over 30 years. And if they leave those camps without permission, then they can end up in the local jail indefinitely. And JRS has known people who've died pending release from those jails, simply because they moved without permission. In Malta, JRS sees people who have fled desperate conditions in home countries, and the reception they receive in a European country is to be put in an army barracks, held for usually around 12 months, simply because they fled persecution or extreme poverty, and they're held while their asylum application is being dealt with. They're being held in very poor conditions in army barracks, which have been criticised by human rights groups worldwide. We've also seen in the Immigration Detention Centre in Bangkok, we know people who've been held in there for years, pending deportations that are often not going to happen because of bureaucracy. And it's not the fault of the individuals who are being held in detention that they can't be deported. And the same is happening in Australia. One case we became aware of, a Kashmiri asylum seeker, his case was rejected. He waited 7 years in immigration detention before Australia finally accepted that it wasn't going to be able to deport him and let him out last year. But 7 years for a man who's committed no crime. All he's done is entered a country.
We see increasingly the detainees themselves protesting these kind of very, very difficult conditions. We see detainees sewing their lips together and staging some quite high-profile protests to try and get the international attention on this critical issue. And yet, up till now, it doesn't seem to have done so, does it?
Sadly, it doesn't. And that's why we're launching this coalition at the moment, because we feel that very often the general public doesn't really get the information about what's happening. Very often people see a detention centre and they think it's a prison. They think people are in there because they've committed a criminal offence or been charged with a criminal offence. They very often do not know that the detention centre next down their road is in fact holding people who've not been charged with any criminal offence. They've simply entered the country without permission. I don't think the public gets the information about how many people are being held in detention. In the United States, every day there are more than 20,000 people being held in detention. Last year, the figures were 230,000 people held in immigration detention. Again, not one criminal charge for any of those people.
And yet part of the public image that is portrayed is that these people, if they haven't committed any crime, they may represent some kind of risk. There's very much a negative image that governments, if not actively trying to put across, are certainly happy to let go, if you like.
Yes, and you know, we understand the difficulties that governments face. We're not suggesting that governments have no right to protect their national sovereignty. We're not suggesting that there is never a circumstance where detention may be necessary for a short period of time. What we are saying is that every time there is a consideration of detention, there should be a judicial oversight of that decision. And alternatives should be considered first. That's all we're saying. If at the in the last resort there is no alternative, and if the detention is meeting human rights standards, that the conditions are acceptable, that there is a time limit on the detention, then there may be circumstances in which we wouldn't oppose it. But we would always ask that alternatives should be considered and that government should live up to the human rights standards that they've signed up to.
Among the other faith leaders supporting this new coalition is Mario Scialoia, president in Italy of the World Muslim League.
We are in an era where the whole population tries to go from poor to rich countries, and evidently there is a limit to the reception capacity of Western countries. So, I mean, we must find a way to help these people at their home in avoiding mass migration, which evidently cannot be accepted, not only by Italy, but by Spain, by France, by Germany, by all Western countries.
What is your message to governments in countries, not just here in Italy, but around the world?
That charity is the same, whether it is Muslim or Christian or Jewish charity, and that we must think that these people are human beings just like us, that they're less fortunate than us, and that we should do all the best, all what we can to help them.
At the moment, we have 100 organisations and individuals who have joined in over 36 countries. I think we said 36 in our press statement. I think it's come to 40 countries now. And we have 17 steering committee members from all over the world and from certainly from different faith groups as well. So we have organisations like Amnesty International. We also have organisations, more local organisations like the Refugee Consortium of Kenya. We have Egyptian organisations, Mexican organisations, Jamaican organisations, and yes, they're from different faith groups as well as different non-faith groups.
The role of the other faith groups perhaps within this coalition is to bring a different perspective on this key human rights issue.
I think it's very important that this issue is talked about in terms of its ethics and its morality, and that's where the faith groups come in. I think that all of the major faiths have a concern for the ethics and morality of the way our societies are treating vulnerable people. And this is a key issue to be looked at in through the perspective of faith and ethics and morality.
My thanks there to Melanie Teff, International Advocacy Coordinator for the Jesuit Refugee Service. And earlier you heard Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino, head of the Vatican's Council for Justice and Peace and the Council for Migrants and Itinerant Peoples, and Mario Scialoia, President in Italy of the World Muslim League. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thank you for joining me. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Don't forget, you can find all our programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.